From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with Margaret Kimberly, who's a columnist with BlackAgendaReport.com with a weekly column entitled Freedom Rider. Her column last week was entitled Contradictions of White Supremacy, and it begins with a discussion of the profiling in the New York Times of an Ohio Nazi. Kimberly discussed the kid glove approach taken by the Times, which was characterized as too obvious, and discusses the reaction of readers and what it means in the larger context of white supremacy in the United States. We spoke with her via Skype Thursday. Let's talk about white supremacy, which means let's talk about something going on in America and the contradictions, which they don't get talked about much.
No, they don't. I was moved to write this article because of a brouhaha in the New York Times. A reporter interviewed a man who is a overt proclaimed white supremacist in Ohio. A man with who can be called a Nazi. He has Nazi memorabilia and so forth. And they gave him the floor, basically, in this interview. No pushback, no nothing. And readers were outraged about this, and I believe that they should have been. But it raised a couple of issues for me. One, this was not the first puff piece about a white supremacist in American media. Richard Spencer, when he was first introduced to the public, it was like he was a new celebrity. Yeah. People talked about his good looks and all kinds of things. It was quite telling to me. And the fact that people are fascinated by them, I don't think there's that much to say. There are a lot of people who are racist. We live in a very racist country, and there are many people who are avowed racists. I don't think that's something that needs to be personalized in the way that the media have done. But at any rate, in this New York Times article, they had to backtrack. They changed the article title. People were writing in. And I thought about a couple of things. The fact that they did this article at all, but also some of the frankly phony outrage that came from New York Times readers and other people who would be aghast if you told them they were racist or that they benefit from white supremacy when they do every day. So I raised the issue, for example, here in New York, all these New Yorkers writing to the New York Times and clutching their pearls about coverage of a white nationalist.
Right.
When we had, when it was at its height, at its worst, stop and frisk, when Bloomberg was mayor of New York City, and black people in particular were being stopped and harassed by the police. And there were actually arrest quotas in New York. I mean, most places there's a quota for writing parking tickets or something, but there was extreme pressure on the police to make arrests. And who do you think that impacted?
Yeah.
But every indication, white New Yorkers thought that was just fine. Every poll showed that most white people thought that was fine.
You know, not and for that, nothing. The New York Times, by the way, was referring to like black teenagers as wolf packs and all kinds of, you know, this whole, they were animalizing black people in the New York Times in the very pages that they're complaining about this now.
Absolutely. They were. And, but if you asked someone, if you confronted someone who thought that those policies were fine, and said, well, that makes you a white supremacist, they would, most of them, I think, would have argued against it. So my first point was that, you know, people can't, we can't let Trump let racism get out of jail free card,
right,
as I say, where if you're not a Nazi, if you're not a white supremacist, you are allowed to live your life without being confronted about the variety of ways in which, as a white person, one has a variety of advantages. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I could go on. You know, people who didn't complain about stop and frisk, people who say nothing about mass incarceration, they either don't care or they think it's a good idea for as many mm-hmm. black people as possible to be locked away. People who gentrify. My neighborhood here in Harlem, I've lived here for about 30 years, and I'd say for 20 of those years, there were hardly any white people. Now, every right. new person who moves in is white, and that's creating displacement.
Right.
And that is racism. That is white supremacy.
Yep.
So, but it's never called that. And so that's an easy out. It's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, I mean, very few
point fingers at a guy who has Nazi memorabilia.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's supposed to, in other words, this normal racism that exists in the country, in other words, the normalized racism that exists, is sort of not covered. Here is an example of not normalized racism, and that personifies all racism. So see those 12 guys over there? They're the racists. The rest of you folks over here, you're fine.
Yeah, yeah, you're good. You know, and you didn't vote for Trump,
right?
And you voted for Hillary, and
right.
so you're okay. Well, I'm saying no, you're not.
Yeah,
necessarily.
I mean, you mentioned mass incarceration, for example, and then you mentioned Hillary. That's one of the first things that popped in my head. Of course, when we go back to Bill Clinton's administration and the various federal bills that both increased the federal prison population and modeled for the state increases that followed.
Yes, and she, of course, supported it and referred to black teens as, was it, super predators?
Super predators,
who have to
yeah.
be brought to heel like
yeah.
black dogs.
Yep, right.
And speaking of animalizing human
yeah, right.
beings.
Yeah, exactly, yep.
So she was in the forefront of something which decimated the black community and is still decimating us in a variety of ways. And yet, because of this political system we have, this duopoly, which does not allow for any other voices to be heard, we have these two parties, which are allegedly polar opposites, but not really. And most black people cling to the Democratic Party to try to fight against the Republican Party, which for the last 50 years or so has been the white people's party. So we desperately cling to this party in order to fight the one that is worse in some ways.
Right.
But in fact, it's just like a kabuki theater of who's
yeah,
who's really
exactly.
worse.
Right.
But because it doesn't matter who's in the White House, the prison population doesn't go down.
Right.
It doesn't matter who's in the White House. Police still have the right to kill with impunity.
Right.
So there's arguing around the margins of what is considered acceptable discourse in this country.
Right.
So here we are giving our votes to these people who don't do any more for us, and in fact can be more harmful because they have the cover of being Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this goes really to the heart of the question of identity politics versus revolutionary politics, so form mm-hmm. versus essence, symbology as opposed to, you know, the material. You have the New York Times propping up symbols of racism, and so people don't see the actual racism, which is, it's right in front of them in their daily lives, but that's not part of the public discourse. You have, a variety of different look at one of the primary examples of the expression of white supremacy that's taken place in the last 50 years, maybe, the recolonization of Africa.
Yes.
But that takes place at the hands of a black president. So it's not racist. It's not white supremacy. It's something else. I mean, in other words, the symbology blurs the material. And then so you have, on the one hand, real racists hiding behind some knucklehead, with a Nazi uniform in Ohio,
right.
And you have real white supremacist, imperial foreign policy hiding behind a black president.
Well, and then another excellent example is Libya.
Right.
Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton destroyed Libya.
Right.
And empowered these. Now Libya, there is no Libyan state as such anymore. There are several factions, rival factions, fighting over that territory. And now we see the literal enslavement of migrants from other African countries.
Yeah, after the lynchings that were at the beginning that were incited essentially by the CIA, which was operating under Obama.
It all happened under Obama. All black towns, such as a city called Tuerga, were literally reduced to rubble.
Incinerated.
Yes, they were. Dark-skinned Libyans and African migrants were targeted for mass murder. And all of this happened because of Obama and Clinton.
Right.
Now it's in the news again because there is some footage of these slave auctions actually taking place. There are stories of organs, people having their organs harvested. And that has something to do, organ trafficking. Israel is the number one country involved in that. That's been documented many times. But now everyone's in an uproar. But nobody wants to mention Obama and Clinton and their role in making this happen. Yes, NATO was involved, but the rest of NATO doesn't act unless the United States gives the go-ahead.
That's right.
And Hillary Clinton and the then UK Prime Minister Cameron and who was France at the time, Sarkozy, all showed up personally in Libya to dance on Gaddafi's grave, so to speak, and to brag about having committed this war crime. That's all it can be called.
Well, Sarkozy,
so now people want to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, Sarkozy, you know, did a little advance dance over in Cote d'Ivoire, by the way, when he sent the French troops in to pull Gbagbo out of the presidential palace at gunpoint. The U.S. sent them there because the first onslaught into Libya was reported in the Pakistan Observer in February of 2011, U.S., U.K., and French troops landed in East Europe on troop transport.
Yes.
Joint project.
But now that this story of enslavement is in the news, many reporters won't even mention Obama and Clinton by name.
I know.
I have called people to task. I have gone on Twitter. I have emailed people, and I have asked them, how do you write about the destruction of Libya and not mention the names Obama and Clinton?
Right.
And then some people are like, can we blame them? You know, but it's still like very, very weak. And talk about, excuse me, color supremacy. My God, but that is something they are directly responsible for having carried out. And the New York Times never, ever covered this, ever.
Nope.
At any rate, so that's another example of the blatant white supremacy, that this happened because of the black president of the United States gave the go-ahead. It would not have happened absent Barack Obama. And people, now he's trying to say he made a mistake in Libya because he didn't plan for the aftermath. And I'm sick and tired of these aggressions. Yeah, these aggressions being called mistakes. Iraq
was
a mistake. Libya was a mistake. Interventions are war crimes.
Yeah.
And American liberals need to stop. They need to call. They are war crimes. They need to be referred to as such. And of course, they're always covered with. In Libya, it was supposed to be a humanitarian intervention. So they made up lies with the help of Human Rights Watch and the International Criminal Court, and the ICC, saying that Gaddafi's troops had been given Viagra and they were all going to go on a raping spree. And these are the kinds of things that were lies that were used to justify the destruction of this country. So, and that's also a kind of white supremacy, the worst kind, actually, where people, a nation was destroyed, people have been killed, people are being killed, people are suffering now because of this country, because of a democratic president who's now being held up as some paragon of virtue because he has better manners than Donald Trump does.
Yeah, there's really low-hanging fruit, too.
Yes, it is.
You know, you've got not just the excuse that it was a mistake, In the case of Libya, all right, we had heard in the case of Iraq about the list of the countries that we got from, Clinton's old Joint Chiefs of Staff head. I can't remember the general's name at the moment, but there was the list of Iraq, Iran, you know, yada, 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 that were all, you know, being targeted for regime change. And so we could see the pattern there, those of us that were, you know, paying any attention. But what list we haven't seen is the one where Libya is the gateway to Africa, because you had the French go into Cote d'Ivoire, and about 2 seconds after the U.S. Started taking down Libya, they went into Mali and a bunch of other countries that were formerly, quote-unquote, French Africa. And you had in the background, through the Bush administration, they were, you know, rumbling that they needed to revive SOUTHCOM and create AFRICOM. And then they actually established AFRICOM legally in October of 2008. In other words, while they were supposed to be busy trying to save the economy because it had tanked and they were, you know, giving the banks trillions of dollars and, you know, all of that, they open up in Stuttgart, Germany, the offices of the African Command of the U.S. military, because no country on the African continent would host them. Even though there's all this money that goes with it, you know, even though there's all kinds of economic benefits, you know, for the moment of, you know, you have here a few thousand people that are going to be buying steaks and cars and whatever from local, you know, folks. Despite all of that, everybody said, hell no. And the main impediment to the U.S. reentering was Libya, who had had the last U.S. military troops in 1969. Right after the revolution in 69, Libya, Gaddafi, evicted them. And that was the last U.S. troops on the African continent with a permanent base. So after they take down Libya, suddenly AFRICOM is installed in 35 African countries and is operating now as, in essence, the command and control for almost all of the militaries on the African continent. What a mistake. They just slipped into, oops, what a boo-boo.
Yes, yes. And so, but they're allowed to get away with these lies because there is not an understanding of, or I guess an acknowledgement of, U.S. imperialism. And because we have these, and I was just thinking of the word, is a very juvenile understanding of politics in this country, where one side of the duopoly is bad, 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 evil. The other side, we have to rejoice if they're in power. But in fact, it's like a tag team. It's like professional wrestling. I mean, many people have said that. It's like there's a phony villain and a phony hero, but the whole thing is phony. And so one side gets to be presented as being evil and horrible. The other side gets to be presented as being good. There's no alternative. Anybody who dares suggest that we seek out an alternative is called a supporter of the evil, bad people. And so it goes on and on and on, where so now you have some cracker in Ohio being profiled in the New York Times. Yes, it's a puff piece, and no, it should not have been. But he gets to stand for all racism in the country as it is practiced. And other people get to pat themselves on the back, people who support horrible things otherwise, some because they're not aware. And I always have to remind myself how the role the media play in just in not telling people things. It's interesting to me. ISIS is out of Syria, for example. Have you seen that in the New York Times?
Yeah, not at all. Nope.
ISIS was supposed to be evil, but it, of course, ISIS was doing America's work for it in attacking the secular Arab regimes. And Putin helped Assad to get ISIS out of Syria. So now you can't, they won't tell you that ISIS has been defeated in Syria.
Right.
ISIS has been defeated in Iraq.
Right.
And so that goes unmentioned. So I think about, and I'm digressing a little bit, but all of the things that are just kept from us, the lies of omission that are just inconvenient. So they are not allowed in the pages of the newspaper. And so people get to have these these views about goodness and badness and racism and not racism that are based on lies or on trivialities.
Right. Artificial parameters. I mean, for example, yes. I don't know how many people this character represents out in Ohio, okay? He gets profiled and is the center of controversy, and we're even speaking about him now just because it's a thing, you know?
Right.
However, not Glenn Ford, Bruce Dixon, Margaret Kimberly, Danny Haifong, Ajamu Baraka, mentioned, except for Ajamu, because he actually ran for vice president. Maybe they mentioned him twice. New York Times never mentioned. I'm looking at blackagendaradio.podbean.com, where the Black Agenda Radio program is hosted. It's a server that radio stations use to download it. 1.794 million downloads. Okay? How many downloads do you think Homeboy out in Ohio has on his little blog page? What, 50, 100, 250, 1,000? And he gets profiled, Black Agenda who? At the New York Times.
Well, and that was my other, and I'm one of the people who wrote to the Times. And I said, can you ever find a leftist to profile?
Right.
And I added, I said, and I didn't say Democrat, I said leftist.
That's right, big difference.
They use these people to gin up hysteria, to help their readers feel superior. And I have not even of the Green Party. I've never seen a profile of a Green Party voter or candidate in the New York Times. Maybe I missed it. I mean, it could have been in there. But that would give legitimacy to people being opposed to the system. That would give legitimacy to people questioning the manufactured consent. So that is something that's forbidden. But they will reach out to this guy and cause a big drama that's also phony.
Yep. Well, let's go back to Crossfire on CNN, for example, which was the debate program that they had. It still is, right. I guess. I think they still use it. The left, quote unquote, you had Tom Brady. Okay, yes. And on the right, you had, I forgot his name, that was in the Nixon administration. He's a kind of a wild man, right-winger. But Tom Brady.
Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan, right. And actually, he doesn't get much airtime anymore because he's actually sort of an oppositionist, you know, more than sort of. He's an oppositionist. He's outside the framework of, you know, official opposition now. But Tom Brady, the leftist, was a CIA official.
Yes.
And his biggest legacy was that he wrote Eight is Enough. The book. He's the author of that. While he was in the CIA, he wrote about his family life, and Eight is Enough came out of that. He represented the left throughout the 80s. Yes. When Reagan was threatening World War III, he was representing us.
Yes, we were told. Yes, exactly. And that's what we get. And people who really are on the left have to be disappeared. And now, of course, they are using Russiagate as an excuse to further disappear. Right. The internet leveled the playing field a little bit and that we all had the ability to seek out new sources of information.
Yep.
So now, under the guise of fighting Vladimir Putin, they've changed the algorithms on Google. So, and I've seen this myself, try to search for articles by name that I wrote in Black Agenda.
Yeah, right. You can't find your own stuff in Google.
It's disappeared. And they admitted that they're doing this. And this is supposed to be to fight the foreign interference from the evil Russians.
Right.
And this is being used to make certain that we don't have a voice at all, that the one vehicle we have been able to use to change discourse, to give new information, to make sure that is disappeared altogether. They're trying to disappear RT and Sputnik altogether. They had to register as foreign agents. They took Congress took RT's press. It's not a pass. I'm sorry. I'm blanking on the term. Credentials. I'm still blanking on the term. But at any rate, so they have been silenced too.
Yep. And let alone lesser quote unquote voices. I don't know the last time I saw Telesur, for example, mentioned at all. And frankly, I don't think they're all that radical, with the exception of their coverage of Venezuela. And yet it's, you know, head and shoulders outside of the, you know, parameters of what the New York Times will cover. Go to the New York Times, you know, world page for the Americas. You would think once in a while this Latin America-based English language media source would be a source of a report once a year. And I've never seen it. So, you know, the complete universe, Press TV, when they report on Iran. I mean, we've been dealing with Iran in the media since at least, if not 1953, 1979. I don't think I've seen the New York Times refer to Press TV once, except when they were beaten up on them for something, I forget, 5-6 years ago that happened, one occasion. That was it. Instead of normally, this is what they say in Tehran on Press TV. This is what they say in Saudi Arabia on Al Arabiya. You know, they don't do that at all.
No, no, they don't. And when Trump announced a couple of days ago that he would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, you would think that some Palestinians would be interviewed.
Right.
And of course, that's not what happened. Ali Abunima from Electronic Intifada said he was interviewed by Russia television, and he was on TV in the UK and some other place. No calls from any American corporate media. So they were, the Palestinians were disappeared, as if that this discussion has nothing to do with them.
Their defender, quote unquote, who really was only defending them to the extent he could attack Trump, was Wolf Blitzer, who worked for AIPAC and was a reporter for the Jerusalem Post. That was the coverage from the Palestinian side on CNN.
He was representing Palestine.
Yep.
That's but that and those are things that Americans, it's frightening to me the degree to which this media that's so all pervasive that it lies to people and spins a whole tale with, you know, sometimes we have to choose a date, Don, to talk about Russiagate.
Yeah.
And the various ways in which it's used to excuse the Democrats' defeat to Trump, to make the case literally for war.
Yeah.
So it is a tremendous, tremendous lie. And they do it. It's very simple, really. They do it by repetition. You just repeat the same things over and over and over again.
Right.
And make sure that a counter argument is never allowed to see the light of day.
That's right.
And you can convince people that and everything bad happening in the world is Vladimir Putin's fault. And the United States has never done anything bad anywhere in the world. That should be a topic for another day.
I mean, all you need to do is interview anybody anywhere else in the world, and they'll give you the lowdown on that. But, you know, all right, you close it with the open white supremacist cannot be the determining factor of how we pursue political action. Amen to that. And then that the same is true of faux outrage from the white liberals, which cannot be trusted either.
No, it cannot. But it just shows you the precarious nature and the failure of black politics, the fact that we don't have black politics anymore, that we allow these trivial matters. I'm not saying racism is trivial, but people being worked up over coverage of a racist guy in Ohio, to allow that to be the determining factor of how we organize. Or frankly, not talking about asking the question of how we organize and how we practice self-determination, so that we're not fooled anymore, we're not jerked around by phony issues, and that we give ourselves permission to critique people who think they're on our side or pretend to be on our side because they can't stomach the fact that some Trump supporter in Nowheresville was given a profile in the New York Times.
Margaret Kimberly has a weekly column at blackagendareport.com under the banner Freedom Rider. We've been talking about her article last week entitled Contradictions of White Supremacy, and thank you very much. We definitely need to speak some more about some of the things you mentioned. Margaret, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.